Game on 2FM.
With Gillette. Great performances begin with a comfortable close shave from Gillette. Gillette, making men's lives just that little bit easier.
Game on 2FM.
It's Tuesday the 26th of May and this is Game On.
And it's Damien O'Mara here alongside Ruby again tonight, and we have the rarest of rare treats and we're going to enjoy it greatly. Live football, we're going to keep a very, very close eye between now and 7 o'clock on Borussia Dortmund against Bayern Munich as it plays out on the TV screens here in front of us.
One is the explosive new hotshot on the block.
That's a good one, that's a good one. Incredible.
Star is well and truly born.
The other is the league's long-established master blaster.
Lewandowski, just when they needed a hero.
And hopefully they'll both get on the score sheet. Plus, we'll be talking with cycling with Nicholas Roach live from Monaco. And we have Irish goal hero John Aldridge even, on football. Slow return on what lies ahead.
Game on 2FM.
So you can text the programme this evening, 51552. We'll get us straight into studio. You can tweet us at GameOn2FM. So we've 32 minutes played in Dortmund. Ruby, I know you can't see the pictures of this, but it's scoreless after 32 minutes. And you know when you watch the videos of like old school English matches and you look at it and you go, Jesus, like lads would be arrested or jailed if they did now what they're doing on the pitch. There's a little touch of that about this, that this, albeit in an empty stadium, there's like full on proper old school tackles going in. It's great to see. Long live the dirty tackle.
Even worse than Dennis Wise and Vinnie Jones, even before that era.
It's tough. Like it's not, it's a couple of crunchers. Like, you know, it's a derby. Like, there's no leg breakers. There's no kind of, you know, ones that would really inflict serious damage, but it's not what you'd normally see in these Bundesliga games or Premier League games. And, you know, to be fair to them as well, there's not an excessive amount of rolling around on the ground. It's like, take your hit and get up and let's play on.
It's gas. I was looking it up today, doing my geography research in Germany, and like Borussia Dortmund, Bayern Munich, it's a derby, but they couldn't nearly be further apart geographically in Germany. One is in the northeast or the northwest, the other is in the southeast.
But it's like, you know, like Liverpool fans would tell you they'll always look at the United game in the diary first. Like, it's who cares about the
That's
game,
only 40 minutes away. Like, yeah, this one looks like 4 hours apart.
But it's just that thing about two big titans going head to head and the two clubs that traditionally, what was it they used to call? Was it Bayern Munich? Was like, what was the nickname they had for them? It was like FC Mercedes or something like that, about, you know, the big money that went in. FC Hollywood, the big money that went into them. So it's the two big,
the two big
just,
teams going head
just
to
all
head.
All about money and all about the two historical big teams, but they're giving it socks. And to be fair to BT Sport, no more than any other broadcaster in the world who's been denied live sport over the course of the last couple of months, the amount of the build-up they did on this, and they have built this into, like, this is the game of all games, the greatest match that will ever take place. And to be fair, it's looking fairly decent.
What is the translation? Der Klassiker, is it?
Yeah.
Der Klassiker?
But do you know, the other thing that struck me beforehand is, so they're doing all these shots from, you know, in the tunnel as the players are getting ready to come out, and it's all fist pumps and they can't do high fives and they can't hug each other the way footballers tend to do the opposing players that they know before the matches. And then you've all the managers up in the, obviously in the technical areas, and they're all wearing face masks. So Dortmund have like branded Dortmund face masks. Some of the Bayern lads are just wearing like the standard one that you'd go in and buy in your local chemist. But I'm wondering, you know the way like every inch of a soccer jersey that can now be covered with a sponsor is covered with a sponsor, how long is it until like we see the big football teams and their manager sitting on the touchline with a face mask which is branded to within an inch of its life with all the sponsors on it?
I'm surprised we're not already looking at it. I would have thought the advertising companies were slow off the mark there, would you not?
I would have thought now some commercial manager somewhere along the way would be looking at the loss of revenue from not having fans there and would say, here, let's make a quick buck now. And
when the Premier League comes back, we'd see Chevrolet across every United player's lips.
But it's like, it's when you see Manchester United in particular. It's, you know, here we now today unveil the official wine partner, and tomorrow we'll unveil the official cork provider for the bottles of wine that we've just announced with our official wine partner. But that's,
you know, wine has gone screw top now, Damien.
See, I wouldn't know.
Every bit as good as the Cork stuff.
There, I'll bow to your knowledge. So there we. So anyway, 36 minutes play. We're going to be chatting to Mark Langdon from the Racing Post about this and other games over the course of the evening. But it's good, tasty encounter. And John Aldridge is going to join us later on in the program as well. Do you social media a bit? Do you?
Very little, I'm afraid.
There were clips doing the rounds.
Left that word behind.
Oh well, you're better off. The clips doing the rounds over the weekend of. So, like, again, we're going to fixate and talk endlessly about matches and different sporting events behind closed doors and the novelty of being able to hear players shouting at each other. But the Bundesliga games that have been broadcast in the States, the broadcasters have decided to filter sound effects underneath it so that it doesn't sound like an empty stadium. But the clips are doing the rounds of some of the Bundesliga matches over the weekend where they're broadcast here with silence and in America with, like, canned crowd effects, and it just is so annoying. It just doesn't work at all.
They do it sporadically in horse racing, some of the bigger channels, when horses are jumping jumps to replicate the noise of the jump. I didn't realise they were doing it until I stopped and was working in some of those channels, but they replicate the sound that the horse is brushing over the jumps as well. So it's probably done a lot more in sport than we realise, Damien.
Yeah, but
than I realised anyway.
Yeah, it's there was a brilliant documentary on the BBC radio a couple of years ago where they talked about how you have to make, say, the Grand National sound what people think the Grand National sounds like, not what it actually sounds like. That people sit at home and you have this idea of what horses running are going to be like. But it just sounds so strange that a goal goes in, but there's no significant increase in the crowd in the background because it's obviously some fella has a sound effect CD. And
there's no one in America watching live to press up on the audio,
or to kind of go, here, hang on, where's my extra sound effect of a crowd cheering along the way? So we'll keep an eye on that anyway. The big, not a day of seismic news in terms of sport, but I'm wondering, has the death nail been put in the Ryder Cup? You would wonder. Rory McIlroy, he's done a fairly extensive interview with our friends up in BBC Northern Ireland, and he chats about all sorts of things. But in the middle of it, was asked for his opinion on the Ryder Cup and whether or not it's realistic to see that the Ryder Cup can go ahead at Whistling Straits towards the end of September. And he basically, well, we'll play the clip of him actually, and let's hear from the man himself and his opinion. And he does stress at the start that this is his personal opinion alone as to whether or not that great battle between Europe and the US will go ahead.
I don't see how it's going to happen, so I don't think it will happen. I think the majority of the players would like to see it pushed back to 2021 so that they can play in front of crowds. That's what makes the Ryder Cup so special. At the end of the day, the players are the ones that make the Ryder Cup, and if they don't want to play, then there isn't a Ryder Cup. So I see it being pushed back to 21, and honestly, I think that would be the right call.
Ruby, if you look at it, if someone of his standing, like he carries an awful lot of weight for one man and one man's opinion, but if he's reflecting what they're talking about in golf WhatsApp groups, is that pretty much the end of the Ryder Cup?
I'd say it's a big dent in it anyway, and I would imagine for a whole lot of reasons, the players wanting to play in front of the crowds, I would imagine for the commercial revenue that a Ryder Cup could draw, ticket sales, hospitality, etc., etc., I think it probably will go by the wayside. I think it'll be a pity. I think it's great viewing and great entertainment, but maybe without the crowd, without the USA fans heckling the Europeans as they walk down the fairways, will it be the same thing? Probably not, but I would think that the Ryder Cup is probably going to be postponed listening to Rory. And it was also interesting listening to him. He said he might come back to Europe to play in Wentworth if that competition was moved to suit his schedule in October. But I thought he was very honest about the Irish Open when asked would he come back to play in that. And he basically gave an honest answer in that, well, doesn't look like it's going to be rescheduled, so how can I give you the answer?
Yeah, I feel sorry for him in a way, and it's a thing that's been discussed on this programme and others a lot over the last couple of years, is that he seems to be one of these fellas that rubs an awful lot of people up the wrong way. And when you kind of break down into the crux of it, like, a lot of people obviously historically annoyed about his comments about, you know, the Olympics and representing Ireland, and then he's done the about turn and would have been set for Tokyo this year. But you kind of do have to admire the fact that if you ask him a straight question and there's no excessive agenda behind you asking it, at least he comes out and gives you a proper answer rather than just providing you some PR spin.
I thought his answer about the Irish Open was a good one. I mean, Irish fans most likely won't be able to go and see the top class players, and therefore the attraction for him and coming home and playing in front of an Irish crowd wasn't there. So I can understand exactly what he said. I thought the other interesting one in sports news today, Damien, was from World Rugby and what they're planning to do to try and, I don't know, stay within social distance guidelines. There'll be no resetting of the scrums. Players have to change their kit at half time. Whole lot of different things. What did you make of that?
I think the vast amount of players changed their kit at halftime anyway, so that's not going to, you know, revolutionise the world. The one about how many conversations do you have about rugby, and how many times do you listen to people who know an awful lot about, a lot more about rugby than you and I would, who talk about the scourge that the reset scrum is on the game? And there's often been plenty of chat about trying to do something to rectify it and something to speed the whole thing up, but you'd wonder if a side effect of COVID-19 is that they finally get rid of them and tidy the whole area up. Surely the game is going to be in a much stronger position, because it's infuriating to be at and it's infuriating to watch.
I think it'll add a lot of speed to the game. If the scrums aren't going to be reset, therefore they'll be awarded a free kick, the game will restart much quicker. It'll be played at a much higher tempo. And also, the report said about the banning of upright tackles. That will enable players to offload the ball a lot more as well, if you have to tackle at a much lower level. So the game of rugby union could be set to step up pace-wise and speed-wise considerably.
But if you just say, if you were to stretch this out then to other sports, you know, okay, your fellas who are in the front row of a scrum are involved in, you know, the eight players in a scrum are at very, very close quarters. Closer quarters than you would have been to fellow jockeys when you were...
I would certainly hope so.
Yeah, but still, you know, it's a conversation that's been had about the close proximity between jockeys when you get, say, into the final stages of a race, or certainly at certain points within a race. I was watching the Lance Armstrong documentary on ESPN last night, and at the start of it, I think maybe trying to educate audiences who don't know anything about cycling, they show a couple of shots of pelotons going down tiny roads in France, and they're just millimetres apart. So if rugby need to take this step, is it something then that you're going to have other sports suddenly being forced to look at?
Possibly, but I'm not in any way scientific, but I guess rugby players in the scrum are static to each other, whereas jockeys on horseback, even if they are side by side, are travelling in a direction somewhere in the region of 30 miles an hour. I imagine cyclists in a peloton are also moving forward. I don't know what way the coronavirus moves, but I'd imagine it moves better with two stagnant people than two moving people.
Yeah, but then just say somebody spits and you can't control where it goes.
It's going to be pretty much outlawed in more sports.
You know, we could get very excessive here about, sure, like fellas sneezing and stuff that's beyond their control. But you know, this, I suppose this is the new reality of the world we're living in.
Yeah, look, I think everyone's going to have to make that decision themselves, whether they're willing to partake in the peloton and go on a cycling race. Are they willing to ride a horse? Will they be willing to play rugby? I think eventually it'll come down to the people who want and the people who don't, and people will have to make their own decisions.
Joshua Kimmich has just given Bayern the lead against Dortmund, 43 minutes played, so we'll chat to Mark about that in a couple of minutes' time. Would you have even the remotest of interest in watching the Lance Armstrong documentary?
No, I don't, to tell you the truth. I think when Lance Armstrong was a cyclist, he brought a lot of interest to cycling. He brought a lot of publicity to cycling. And then obviously Lance Armstrong became was the person who he was. And no, I don't.
I watched it last night and like very early in it. So this is the first of two parts ESPN have done. I think it runs to about 90 minutes, the first half of it. I've watched the vast amount of it. And he comes through at the start and talks about, you know, this is my truth. But sure, like, he's done so many interviews over the last couple of years where he's claimed to have told the truth, and then the next time he does another interview, the truth has changed ever somewhat. And you kind of wonder, for the benefit of the sport, you'd just be as well off if he just decided, this is me, I'm gone, and just shuts his mouth. But he's obviously the type of man who craves attention and craves the spotlight, and he's a really odd stuff, really odd part at the start of it. If you've watched the 10 episodes of The Last Dance about Michael Jordan and the Bulls, I would say the first 3 minutes of the Lance Armstrong thing has the F word in it more than the 10 episodes of The Last Dance, because he talks about how he expected people to abuse him after he got caught out, and how it took years for people to come up and start screaming obscenities at him, and how he almost regretted the fact that people didn't abuse him in public, that he could have a cutback off them. He's obviously a very unique individual.
I think people were that disappointed in what he had done that they just kind of left him be. It was gone beyond roaring obscenities at him.
Yeah.
It was just the disappointment and the letdown, and I think he let so much down people didn't really want to abuse.
Almost destroyed a sport. We've a text in from Paul in Sligo, wants to know if you're happy about RTE's announcement of their racing coverage today. So if people haven't got a hold of this, Irish Racing set to return next month. Increased coverage across RTE television. Confirmation today of a series of new one-hour live evening programmes in June and July. There'll be live coverage of Irish Racing on 8 of the first 20 days following the resumption of racing here on the 8th of June. It includes the first classics of the season at the Curragh, the Irish 2000 Guineas on the 12th and the 1000 Guineas on the 13th. The Irish Derby weekend with the Irish Oaks as well also involved. So the new programmes to run between 7 and 8 on a Friday evening and 5 and 6 on Saturdays and Sundays. Hugh Cahill joined by Jane Mangan, Ted Walsh and Ruby. Just a lot of people, you know, there are people who will sit down, Ruby, in front of the television of a weekend and they'll knock great enjoyment out of sitting there for a couple of hours and watching an entire card. But what difference do you think compressing it into, say, a shorter version can have on how people enjoy the sport and maybe what people can learn from the sport?
Well, I think any programme has to entertain you, Damien. And I think if you were to put the whole of the cards on the television, unfortunately the 25 minutes between one race and the next is quite boring, and with social distancing and with no crowds, no atmosphere, no owners, no trainers, you can't do profiles on yards. How do you fill that time? So by, I think, minimising the programme to an hour, two live races, replays of the previous races that can be dissected and shown to you, and maybe educate people, and people will be able to see racing for what it is. I think it's a huge opportunity for horse racing. I think it's a big opportunity for it to show that it is more than just gambling, more than fancy hats, and more than just rich people. It's a huge sport, and it's a massive, massive industry with a lot of normal people going about their business. And I think having the sporting floor to itself, racing has a great opportunity to try and win over some more new fans.
Do you think mainstream media, for the most part, does enough to explain the tactics and explain the brilliance of jockeys? Opposed to, like, I find it so frustrating in the middle of Cheltenham that all people want to talk about is this 50-1 shot that has done something without necessarily trying to delve into how it happened or why it happened or what bit of brilliance somewhere along the way facilitated it happening.
Yeah, I think that gets passed over because people want to know more about the future than they do the past. But I think racing can be quite technical in how it explains things. And I think it needs to use a much more simpler language and explain and highlight and show people what's happening. Subtle movements in racing can make huge differences. And hopefully somewhere along the way between myself, Jane Mangan and my dad, we might be able to explain that to you in one of our shows.
There you go. How significant do you think the quality of racing will be? Because obviously people fixate on footballers are rusty, rugby players are rusty, different players are going to need a little bit of time to get up and running. Obviously we're dealing with the creme de la creme of the beast in terms of what animals partake in sport here. Like, how excited are you about what's going to unfold?
These horses would all have been aimed to have been ready to run in April time. So horse racing was always deemed necessary, whatever it was during the COVID-19 lockdown, it had to continue. So the horses will be as fit as they would have been, probably even fitter. So I think a lot of people in racing will hit the ground running and try to make up for lost time. So I don't think rusty will be something that's going to come into vocabulary too often.
All right, we've loads to fit in between now and 7 o'clock. We're going to chat shortly to Mark Langdon. Half-time in that game between Dortmund and Bayern. Bayern leading by a goal to nil. Nicholas Roach set to join us in a few minutes' time as well.
Game on! European football.
Welcome back to Game On. As Damien said before the break, we were going to be joined by Mark Langdon, who's obviously not in Dortmund, but is keeping an eye on this game for us. And at the moment, Mark, home advantage for Dortmund doesn't seem to be winning out.
No, that's right, Ruby, and it's kind of carrying on the theme of what we've seen in the Bundesliga already this season, because only three teams out of 18 matches have won at home so far in these empty stadiums. And at half-time, Bayern Munich lead this massive game at the top of the table by 1-0. I think, actually, Bayern are a little bit fortunate to be ahead. Dortmund have definitely had the better of the game, but just before half-time, Joshua Kimmich used to play at right-back. He's been moved in to the midfield positions these days, and he produced a chip from the edge of the box that floated over the Dortmund goalkeeper, Roman Bürki, to give Bayern that 1-0 lead, and if they hold on, they'll go 7 points points clear at the top of the table. It was a delightful finish. I think the goalkeeper, Berkey, though, having got a hand to it, will be very disappointed that it floated over his head and into the net.
And obviously, if Bayern won, as you said, it would put them 7 points clear at the top.
Yeah, and, you know, it's difficult enough catching Bayern, you know, even if it was only, they only had a 1 point lead, which is what Dortmund need to do. You know, if they can win, they can get it back to 1 point. You'd still make Bayern favourites. If they go 7 points clear, it feels like it will be as, you know, as good as all over. So a huge second half coming up from Dortmund. They need to make sure that at the very least they come away with something from this game, but realistically it's a match they need to win. And you know, they created enough chances in that first half to think that there's still opportunities for them. Erling Haaland had a shot cleared off the line, and he's also snatched a couple of other opportunities, so maybe that there'll be a bit more luck for him in the second half.
And at 7:30, Mark, Bayer Leverkusen are taking on Wolfsburg. Which one would you see that? What way would you see that one going?
I think that Bayer Leverkusen should win the game. They've come roaring out of the traps in their first two matches since German football returned. They had a brilliant 3-1 win at Borussia Mönchengladbach on Saturday. Kai Havertz has been the star of the show for them. He scored 2 goals in each of his last two matches. He's been linked with a move to Liverpool. People are calling the new Michael Ballack. Instead of playing in midfield, he's playing up front at the moment, but he's had a stunning couple of weeks.
And Bremen have a massive game against Mönchengladbach tonight as well. I mean, they're second from bottom. They could really do the result, couldn't they?
Yeah, they really could. I mean, they're a long-standing sort of top-flight team in Germany, so it'd be a real big shock if they do go down. But we've seen big teams go before. In fact, their great rivals, Hamburg, are already down in the second division. Stuttgart, another kind of giant, really, of German football, relatively speaking. You know, they're also in the second division. So, you know, it doesn't, just because you're a big club doesn't mean you deserve to stay up. They did get a big 1-0 win at Freiburg on Saturday, which was definitely needed for their coach, Kofeld. But there's still a big class gap between them and Gladbach. And, you know, I'd probably take Gladbach to win the game.
And Freiburg are in action against Frankfurt. Both teams sort of in mid-table, not a huge amount to play for at this stage. Could be a dreary one, could it?
Yeah, I mean, it's probably the bigger game for Eintracht Frankfurt, because their coach, Adi Hütter, is coming under increasing pressure. They conceded 5 at Bayern at the weekend, not having the season they were expecting. They were semi-finalists in the Europa League last season, like you say, doing nothing much this year. They did sell their 3 best players in the summer. Haller went to West Ham, Jovic went to Real Madrid, and Rebic went to AC Milan, so that they brought in a huge amount of money, haven't invested it wisely, they haven't really spent as much as maybe they needed to either. So perhaps not a big surprise if you sell your best players, you know, you get worse.
Mark, just on Germany and the return to live football, there was always going to be a particular focus on the significant European League, which got up and running first. And the Germans, if we want to use that terrible stereotype and their efficiency, we should have expected this to have been brilliant. And it really has been a model upon which the other significant leagues can really look at getting back into action.
I think so, yeah. The plan that they put in place was so detailed, you know, even down to what temperature hotel rooms had to be. And, you know, everybody was fully aware of just about every single rule. And, you know, the players have got to live very vanilla lifestyles when they're not playing football, but they've accepted that situation. You know, when people have broken the quarantine rules, like Heiko Herrlich did, the Augsburg coach, the other week, he forgot toothpaste, went to a shop to get some, and that was against the rules, and he wasn't allowed to be on the sidelines for a recent match. So every fine little detail has been planned, and you know, it does need that kind of military style operation to get it going. But so far, so good. The kind of testing and the tracing has been fantastic. Of course, Germany are in a different place to a lot of, or certainly to some European countries, in that hadn't had as many deaths as some of the other kind of major European nations, and that their testing was of a much greater and sort of more significant standard than what others were as well. So I think that has helped them kind of get a head start on the rest, but it's certainly a template to use, and the fans have done their part. There's been the odd protest with banners left outside stadiums for those that think that football shouldn't be going on at the moment, but as far as congregating around stadiums, there's been none of that, and long may that continue, because I think if that happens, it becomes a problem.
Yeah, and we spoke on the programme last week, or last night even, about La Liga and their attempts to get up and running in the middle of June, but I fully appreciate that in every jurisdiction there's different rules around social distancing and what's allowed and everything else, but like UEFA and governing bodies, is there a kind of a negligence around this to the extent that they are leaving it up to the individual governing bodies on a kind of an ad hoc basis to make up the rules from country to country?
I think it has to be. I think it's such a unique situation that we sort of the whole world find itself in. I think that UEFA would be loath to kind of push any kind of rules on any government, because each country is in different stages of lockdown and coming out of lockdown in different ways, and have got different rules over social distancing. And I think that it's ideally, yes, you would want sort of one rule or one law, but I don't think that's possible at the moment. And I think the main thing, and all UEFA really are interested in, from a football point of view, is to get these leagues sort of over by the end of July so they can run the Europa League and Champions League competitions in August. And to be honest, I think they'll just let government and sort of football associations do whatever they need to make sure that that happens.
Mark, would you have any worries about English fans when the Premiership starts back up again? Do you think they will be as, obey the rules as much as the Germans have?
Well, just on that, there's not a chance in hell that Liverpool fans aren't going to congregate somewhere after waiting 30 years to win a league title.
No, you would assume not, that it would cause some issues. You have had, and Liverpool, the team that are getting targeted here, because they're on the verge of this title, and it could be the same for Leeds United in the Championship, or one of the teams at the bottom, if they stay up on the final day or something like that. There is that danger, and I think if that happens, it could see the collapse of the season, or certainly the hopes to playing them at sort of home grounds. You've got to sort of trust people, I suppose, and until they prove otherwise, I expect that the Premier League teams will have to pay extra for policing around the stadia to make sure that it's kept in check there. But like you say, you couldn't sort of keep that everywhere, could you? I mean, what's to say the gathering doesn't happen somewhere else in a city centre or something like that? I mean, it's definitely a concern, but I suppose you've got to hope that the clubs and the fans can work together. That's what's happened in Germany. It's not just sort of laying down the law to the supporters. There was a lot of dialogue about why things need to happen that way, but it would also have to be said that the German fans have a closer links to the clubs than what maybe the Premier League teams do as well. So it's a definite danger, and not just for Liverpool fans, for a whole host of different teams in different situations. It would be my biggest fear as well. But I think you've got to give it a go of at least playing these games in home stadiums. I don't like the idea of neutral venues for everybody. I struggle to see that one really getting through the vote.
Well, Mark, thanks for taking our call. If there's any more action in Dortmund, we will be back to you. Thank you very much.
Tweet at GameOn2FM.
And you're very welcome back to the programme. A reminder, 51552 is our text number. You can tweet us as well at GameOn2FM. So we are going to chat to John Aldridge later on in the programme. We're going to keep an eye on that game between Dortmund and Bayern. Still 1-0 to Bayern the second half, just after getting underway there. And as you would expect across a number of different sports, there are sports people who kind of set out at the start of the year with a certain calendar about how events were going to pan out, and that obviously has all had to be torn up. And I suppose over recent weeks we may well have been getting stuck in to chat about the Giro d'Italia, and we'd be looking ahead to the Tour de France and Olympic cycling and everything else, but that's all had to go by the wayside. And one man who's readjusted his training calendar joins us now. Nicholas Roach is with us. Nicholas, how are you?
Hi, how are you? All good, thank you very much.
And thanks for being with us. I was looking at it on the face of it. If I was to say to most people, you have to self-quarantine and you can do it in Monaco, they might say that would be quite the attractive proposition to relax and look out over the splendour of that part of the world. But you're readjusting to slightly looser restrictions and a significant change maybe in training from what you've had to endure over the last couple of weeks.
Yes, exactly. Like you said, you know, the localization, when you talk about Monaco, you think about the glamour and the Grand Prix. But at the end of the day, it's about the space where you're locked up. That's important. And the restrictions were very, very, very strict here in Monaco. So there was very, very little chance to go out. You could, like, a little walk was tolerated an hour a day, and obviously the grocery and pharmacy trips for in case of emergencies. But no, I was stuck on my balcony for most of my training for 57 days. We had just 8 weeks of full lockdown. So had to adapt, had to learn how to find a little bit of pleasure, if I can say, in home training, which is not something that I was quite used to. The last 2 weeks now, we've been lucky enough let out, so we can ride up to 100 kilometers from our home, which is, you know, more than enough. And I mean, we've been extremely lucky as well. The weather has been spectacular, so I'm enjoying every second of it. Mm.
But just even the simple logistics, that while Monaco looks fantastic for the Formula One Grand Prix and those narrow, windy roads lend themselves to that so brilliantly, it's far from ideal for you to do a loop of Monaco over and over again. So are you effectively left in the apartment to mount the bike and have it in some kind of a stand and just off you go for a couple of hours at a time?
Yeah, exactly. So I was using a home trainer and using some online training platforms to make it a little bit more interactive. So like I said, we were just over 7 weeks on full lockdown, which we weren't allowed to go outside at all. So it wasn't like in Ireland we could go 1K or 2K. And then we had 1 week where we were allowed to go out just in Monaco. And some of the riders did laps of Monaco. And like you said, just said, mainly around the Monaco Grand Prix course, because they're kind of the bigger avenues. Which I didn't really do it. My brother, who was living in France, was still in lockdown. So, I mean, he was keeping me company over all these interactive programs on, like, Swift or whatever on internet. So I thought I'd give him an extra week of company as well and not let him down the last week. So, but now we're lucky enough we can train. But, yeah, it wasn't fun, definitely not.
Nicholas, obviously diet and weight are huge for cyclists as well, and a lot of people wouldn't understand the weight part of it, but have you been able to maintain your weight and your diet pretty much through the lockdown as well?
Well, that's a very good question, because that was my main concern. More than losing fitness was, I've been working pretty hard over the winter to be in top shape, and I was pretty good in shape and already had a good weight earlier on in the season. I didn't want to throw all my sacrifice that I made over the last couple of months during lockdown. So the first couple of weeks, lucky enough, because I had this online race, the Tour Suisse, to look forward to, I took it a little bit like a challenge. So I really kept a very strict diet, looking forward to that. Obviously, I was living alone in 47 square meters. So one of the biggest pleasures in life is also enjoying a bit of dinner, although I was on my own. But I was, you know, tolerating once in a while, just to compensate all those sacrifices, a glass of wine here and there, and treating myself with a good meal once or twice a week, just because it was so important to go through this period mentally stable, if I can say, you know. So I enjoy a glass of wine, I enjoy a glass of whiskey, so those were my little treats. Some might, you know, enjoy a kilo of chocolate, where it was important to find a balance between doing as much sacrifices as I could while I was training, and obviously being able to cut down on some of the meals to be able to enjoy a little bit more of my evening meals, which I would not normally do when I would be full on racing. I'd kind of cut off in the evening and maybe have a better meal for lunch, where I was trying to adapt my things because evenings were long. And to be able to survive those 8 weeks of lockdown, my pleasures were, I kept, like, you know, Friday, Saturdays as my kind of calorie let down moments, and really tried to keep a bit of pleasure through that, not just on your focus on training, because obviously we don't know when we're starting back. And my goal was not to put on weight, which I didn't. I kind of stabilized through the 8 weeks, and now, you know, there's 3 months to the next race, so there's loads of time to bring that last kilo and a half, 2 kilos that I still have for the Tour.
Nicholas, you're part of Team Sunweb. As a team, when will you start training again?
No idea. As a team, it is very, very difficult to know when we will gather again, because we're all coming from different countries with different regulations. And today, the main problem is the right to travel from one country to the other. A lot of the borders are still very closed. And if you travel, they oblige you to do another two-week quarantine. So I do not see this happening until end of July. I have talked to the team. Every Monday, we have different groups with different sports directors. So we are a group of seven with one specific sports director, and we do every Monday morning an hour conference, and it keeps that vibe going in the team, and you still see face-to-face your teammates, and we got kind of some kind of homework as well, which is pretty good. So from one week to the other, we have to give in emails, and it's quite some interaction with the team, which I find was an excellent idea, bearing in mind that my team is the youngest team in the peloton, so there's a lot of riders who are just like 22, 23. So it's really good to keep them kind of going, at least on the theoretical side and not just on the physical side. But we keep in touch, like I said, every Monday. But as a physical get-together, I can't see that happening before end of July.
As you just said there, Team Sunweb is a younger team. Do you find yourself as a sort of role model to those guys?
I hope so, in a way, and in many ways, actually, because, you know, I did my career. I mean, the best years are behind, although I still believe I still have some good years into me. But it's quite nice. I've had, you know, funny enough, the fact that there's a big generation gap is actually easier for me to get on with them than when there was only 4 or 5 years difference. I found that when I was with riders that were 4 or 5 years difference, there was still that competition against me, where these riders are riders, you know, most of them are 10 years younger than me, and they'd be looking at me when I was in the peak of my career in, you know, 2012, 2014 and all that, and getting the big results and seeing me in the pack. And they have a lot of more, they have a different eye on me, as they don't see me as competition. They see me as help, and it makes our communication very helpful and very easy to go along with. And, you know, when we're at the center table and they ask me for stories and I tell them stories, and we have very, very interesting chats, and I really enjoy my role there in that kind of, sometimes I laugh and I'm like the Jedi and they're like my Padawans. But it's just more for the laugh at the dinner table.
But Nicholas, at the same time though, while maybe the targets and the expectation that you might place on yourself might have changed over the years, the competitive flames, I would presume, still burn strong. I know you spoke very openly about Tokyo and the Olympics being a target for you for this year. That's now obviously not to be the case, but how, like, just say your prominence, say, in the Grand Tours, if they do go ahead this year, how has your schedule changed now as a result of the slightly disjointed year compared to what the plan might have been setting out on the World Tour this year?
Yes, once again, very good point there. It doesn't mean that I want to help the young lads, but I'm putting a part on my personal goals. I'm still very competitive, as a person, and physically capable at the moment to still get up some good results. So obviously I'm spending a lot of time supporting the young lads and sharing my experience. Doesn't mean I still don't want to beat them, which I still want to do. And when I'm training camp, I make sure I still beat them and show them that I'm still physically more capable than most of the lads. But in terms of program, so once again, the team said that they're going to come back to us around the 15th of June. So just over 2.5 to 3 weeks now, just because there was a lot of races that were still not confirmed. Some have already been cancelled, and they were waiting for the UCI calendar to be a little bit more established. It looks like the calendar looks to be a little bit more stable now this week. So now they're going to look at different goals. I've already told the team, I said, just before I'm giving my hands up that I'm capable of doing 2 Grand Tours at the end of the year. And if I need to race in November in the Vuelta, I can do that. So hopefully my perfect program, but this is just my own personal opinion without having any consultation with the team. If the team said, what do you want to do? I would say some kind of race in August as a preparation race to the Tour, and then Tour, some race in October to go through the month of October, and then the Vuelta at the end of the year. But once again, this is just me saying, this is my wish list, not at all concerting the team, but hopefully it'll be along that line.
Nicholas, you've often said in the past that your own body clock, the Tour de France came a bit early for you in June, and maybe in July, August, September, you were a better cyclist. Would an August Tour de France be appealing to you now?
Totally. I've always said that. I've said for years, I said, oh, if the Tour or the Giro was in September, it'd be great. Now it is. Once again, the problem is it will depend on what the team wants. The team has spoken quite openly about not having any GC riders for the Tour de France this year, and that they were going to look at breakaways and mainly sprint train with Orkay's Ball or Michael Matthews. So, you know, if I have a bit of freedom, it would be amazing, because I could potentially fight for maybe a top 10, 12 in the Tour. But it looks like the team, if they make me go to the Tour de France, will most likely be to kind of give a hand in the earlier work of the sprint teams, bearing in mind that then I will have open cards on the more mountain stages for breakaway, which is also good, because also, you know, I've dreamt of being top 10 in the Tour. I missed out a couple of times, 12th and 14th. But one of the things that I really, really want is to chase one of those stage wins, which I haven't done yet. So if I can be in the top of my shape and try and make the most of those mountain stages in September in my best shape, rather than, you know, in July, I've always been beaten by someone who's stronger. So hopefully me being that little bit stronger again in September might make the difference and fill in one of my dreams of a stage win.
And Nicholas, if my maths is right, I think this would be your 10th tour. Now, obviously, you know, anyone who knows, even people that don't know anything about cycling, the yellow jersey, the Maillot Jaune, is so iconic worldwide. But is that a race that has an added significance for you, obviously because of your own background and, you know, growing up in France, and obviously the family heritage that's involved as well?
Yeah, obviously. I mean, also, you know, when you're a kid, you initially dream of the Tour de France. You know, apart from those very specific classic riders who might dream of a Paris-Roubaix or Tour of Flanders, but you know, I mean, with Dad being a GC rider and myself growing up into a GC wannabe rider, looking at the Tour de France was always my dream. And I think this is also why, although physically I was more built for breakaways, I kind of trained myself as much as I could to be a better climber, so that I can have a chance in those Grand Tours. But the Tour is a dream to be good in the Tour. You know, everything you do in the Tour has double or triple the significance as any other race you do. And like you said, the dream of the Maillot Jaune is something that is just you know, just always in the back of your mind.
But is it inconceivable to you that you could potentially go around the roads of France and not have a sinner roadside? It would be, for all the sports that could take place behind closed doors or away from fans, like, I can't imagine what it would be like to do some of those climbs without the crowd literally being on top of you.
Yeah, I guess it would be something very, very strange indeed. You know, in my opinion, 2020 is going to be a very different year when it regards to sporting events. But if one of the conditions is that we have to do it with limited crowds, well, you know, we just have to think, yes, this is how it must go ahead. Obviously, if it's safe enough and we can have the crowds, please, let's have millions on the road, because you always get the odd guy who's in your way. But, I mean, you know, the crowds do push you, and this is what you dream when you're a kid. You're going up to Alpe d'Huez and you have goosebumps from the crowds. It just, you know, it's just indescribable, the feeling of what the crowds bring. And it's like you said, it's just the whole scenario, you know, it's a big picture, where going up these big climbs with no one on the side of the road, obviously it's going to be very different. Although, you know, most of the races we do during the year have very little crowd on the side of the road, so it's not like we're not used to racing with no crowds. When we do, you know, Tour Catalunya or some of the stages in Paris-Nice, you do some very famous climbs with no one, and then especially in Paris-Nice, and then maybe a couple of months later you go back on the same road in the Tour de France, and it's just chock-a-block. So the crowd is very particular to the Tour. We don't get all those crowds on every single race. So we're actually more used to racing with less crowds than with those big crowds that you would have in the Tour of Italy or in the Tour de France, because already in the Tour of Spain, the crowds are not as important as the previous two Grand Tours. But it would definitely be something missing. But like I said, if it's what it takes to get the race going this year, it's a sacrifice we must make.
And I think, Nicholas, if it was on and there was no one there, we might all just sit down and watch it this year. We're that starved of live sport, and we wish you every success through the autumn and winter months ahead. Thanks a million.
Thanks very much.
Game on.
On 2FM. Weekdays from 6.
Welcome back to Game on 2FM. And, well, Liverpool are going to win the league 30 years later, but there's going to be nobody there. So we went and found someone who will be there in a commentary role, more than likely, and that is John Aldrich. How are you, John?
I'm all right, lads. How are you?
Oh, we're great. We're hanging in there. You must be excited about Liverpool winning the league, but it's going to be in pretty strange circumstances.
Yeah, it's the only thing. It's the only way they can do it, unfortunately. No real other options. But they'll get what they deserve, what they merited at the end of the day, and that's the most important thing.
John, soccer's going to be quite different with no crowds, no atmosphere. The English game relies a lot on that. Do you think people will look and watch more of the technical aspects of soccer now?
They might, yeah, possibly. I'm just watching now as you're talking, just watching the Dortmund, the Bayern Munich game, you know, obviously in the same sort of surroundings, and it is quite strange, but yeah, you know, it is different. From a player's point of view, when I put myself on that sort of situation, it's strange, it's eerie, because you're used to, obviously, people being on top of you, the atmosphere, so it will be interesting, obviously, yeah.
How have you found watching Bayern Munich and Borussia Dortmund tonight? Do you find it strange as an ex-soccer player to watch an empty stadium?
Yeah, but it's that all nothing at the end of the day. So, you know, best having some football rather than nothing, and slowly but surely get back into the swing of things. That's the most important thing down the line, you know. We get back to normality right across the board after, you know, a horrendous few months.
John, you obviously played in Spain as well, and La Liga is set to return. Now, for most people outside of Madrid and Barcelona, we don't know a whole lot about those clubs. You were in Sociedad. What can we look forward to? Will it be quite technical? Is there some big rivalries there that we're not aware of?
When I went there, it was completely different to the first division / Premier League. It's more tactical, you know, technical. It wasn't as, you know, full in your face. You know, that's why people love the Premiership even now. It's always been the same. You know, it's in your face. It's a million mile an hour. You know, in Spain it was, you know, slower build-up. And then when you get your one chance or your two chances, you have to put it away. You know, whereas in England, sometimes you got three or four chances. In Spain, playing up front on my own, it was really hard. I had to wait for that one opportunity to come along and make sure I took it.
John, just aside from the obvious love you have for Liverpool and the desire to watch those matches, as you look across Europe, which for you is the real standout league if we take away the kind of marketing that exists around the Premier League, which tries to convince us all that it's unquestionably the best league in the world?
I think you only have to look at where the money is. You know, years ago, the money used to be in Italy. You know, so people said that was the best league, didn't they? But I always think the best one to watch has always been the English, you know, First Division, the English Premier League, and that's why people pay, you know, top dollar, the most money to that league, because right across the world, you know, it's the most popular. Because, you know, sometimes, you know, in Italy and Spain, you know, it's a slower game. It's more exciting, I think, the Premiership, and you do get. Well, over the past, you know, so loads of years, you do get a lot more results that you wouldn't expect. Whereas in Spain and Italy, that didn't happen quite as much.
Sean, the old First Division that you were in with Tranmere, now the Championship is back training and looks like resuming as well in the near future. Would you have worries for clubs in the Championship financially going forward, no gate receipts? How are they going to survive?
Absolutely. I was only talking to a friend of mine who used to, you know, both have played amateur football, you know, when we were young. And you look of what's compiled with what's happened, and, you know, if teams have left themselves vulnerable and haven't looked after the books, you can see in the next year or so some clubs folding or restarting in some way or form, you know, like Bury did. Unfortunately, I can see that happening a bit. It's going to be so sorry for, because you're looking at, you know, the wider perspective of things. It's the locality and the people around the club who support him, and it's a way of life for them. You know, that would be the sad thing if and when that happens. You know, but like just Tranmere, I think Tranmere, the, you know, Palios, who runs Tranmere, who used to work for the FA, you know, they can bounce back. You know, they'll be able to balance the books and come out of a good side. I think some, unfortunately, quite a few clubs may not do that. And, in the next couple of years, we may see the league structured a little bit differently.
Obviously, promotion and relegation will be huge. I mean, it would be such a financial boost for Leeds to get back up. But what about the clubs going down? How big a loss is it going to be to them?
Yeah, massive. Absolutely massive. Again, going back to what you said, if they've left themselves vulnerable, on the financial side, it's really problematic. But it's okay going down, but if they've left themselves too much to bounce back, that's where the door may open and they might fold. You know, so it could be some sad times to come. Hopefully not.
It'll be some sad and stark times to come, and just down the road will be one huge celebration, John. If it is all behind closed doors, have you any plans for what you're going to do when Liverpool eventually lift that trophy?
I haven't yet. I'm just waiting for the games to start, and you know, I work for LFC TV, and you know, if I'm working on the game, then you know, I'll have a party when we get home. But you know, everyone will have to, you know, be 6 feet apart, some way or form. I'll structure it some way or form so it is the right way, because Liverpool should never have had to wait for 30 years to lift, you know, the top prize. You know, unfortunately, we have, and, you know, it's coming back. And Liverpool fans are getting very excited about it, obviously.
And they're the only ones getting excited about it. John Aldridge, thanks a million for taking the call.
It's a pleasure, lad. You take care. All the best.
So that's John Aldridge there. We have 71 minutes played, Ruby, in the game between Dortmund and Bayern. Haaland has gone off injured for Dortmund. And Jerome Boateng is trending on Twitter because he's given away what was a clear-cut penalty for handball and did the old trick of faced the opposite direction and stuck his elbow out so the referee wouldn't think it was on purpose. But VAR said no. So anyway, there we go.
VAR.
We best leave it there. Thanks, Ruby. Chat to you again.
Cheers, Damien. Mind yourself.
Thanks to Daniel Keating, who was our broadcast coordinator tonight. Ronan Lawler produced from all of us here.
Game on 2FM.